From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome, everybody, to another edition of The Bucket List, brought to you by our friends at Infinity Sports Travel. Joining me on the cruise ship this time are my shipmates, Giles Morgan and Roger Mitchell. Giles, how are you, my friend?
Grant, it's nice to see you and Roger again. It's been a little while. I've had a 3 or 4 week sort of sabbatical from Are You Not Entertained, and I've enjoyed not listening to myself in the headphones and really enjoying listening to the two of you. It's been wonderful just to immerse myself on my travels with your shows. Fantastic stuff.
Well, I'd love to tell you how much we missed you, Giles, but I'll leave that to Rog. Rog, how are you, mate?
I'm good. We did miss him. I kept thinking, what is he doing in Saudi all over the place? They get the odd text at midnight, do you want to come to Cheltenham tomorrow? That kind of thing. Gilo is back huge. What's happening around the world, my friend? Tell us what's going on.
Well, I had the great pleasure of going down to Saudi Arabia to Riyadh with Howden, who are my employer. We're involved with the Saudi Cup, which is the world's richest horse race. Astonishing. We've talked a lot about Saudi Arabia. We've talked about its influence clearly in the world of sport. And it's easy to pontificate. It's much better just to get the worm's eye view and try and get a sense. It was lovely to catch up with some friends from the show. Danny Townsend was down there, which was great. Nathan Homer is there working for NEOM. And just to talk to people who are there on boots on the ground about the astonishing social changes that are happening. There's much to do, and I don't think this bet is a dead cert, and I don't mean that critically, but Saudi is putting a huge investment in to the world of sport. So to see it has been a real privilege for me, I have to say, and I'm looking forward to going back. I then went from there to Dubai, which is obviously quite a different proposition, great fun, and then down to Sydney, which is a really deeply different proposition, and ended up in some hot spots in Manly, which was quite entertaining, pre-Lions tour next year. And then, as you say, Roger, came back and literally 3 days later found myself at where every Irishman's spiritual home at Cheltenham at the racing festival, and managed over 3 days to lose bets on 14 races in a row. So don't follow my tips. That would be my tip for all our listeners.
Shallow, I have to say, they say a leopard can't change his spots, but I am delighted to hear you've ended up in some hot spots in Manly as opposed to some Manly hot spots like you did in the old days. So that's a welcome change. A welcome change.
It is. You know, I feel I've grown up, Grant.
Yeah, I just want to ask, Giles, you know, on that, it's been you know, quite a while now you're back in the hot seat in the sponsorship thing. I know the answer to this because every so often you ping me, but has the quality of the decks that you're seeing improved, Giles? The sponsor pitches that you've seen, let's be honest, has it improved?
I would say what's improved, Rog, is that the quality of PowerPoint or the equivalent, I think some of the slide transitions are a little bit better. The content still feels very, very similar to me, still leading with the what we are rather than what we provide in terms of the fan base. No, it's still work in progress. And I thought after 4 or 5 years of us banging the drum about a new currency for sport that that the decks would be changing from the sales folk. But I think there's still work to be done. So, it's interesting being back on the receiving end of people beseeching companies for money. I think still there's a great deal of trying to explain why someone's digital community, i.e. the fan base, could be so valuable to a brand. And that has got a lot of work still to do. So it probably means, Roger, there's a second book in you to really hammer the point home, because maybe it's still lost by a few folk.
You've been listening to Deck Talk with Roger Mitchell and Giles Morgan. Thank God neither of you are Kiwis. Why don't we do the smart thing and bring the brains of this particular operation on our very special guest, Giles? Why don't you let everybody know who is about to join us?
Well, I'm really chuffed. We've talked about the bucket list and events that are on the bucket list. And the game of golf is a sport that we've talked a lot about. How could we not, over the last 2-3 years, as the sport performs its own peculiar version of harakiri? And yet the sport we've always talked about, there are probably three events within the golf calendar that have remained probably impervious to all of the slings and arrows that have befallen the sport, which is, in no particular order, but probably in date order, the Open Championship, the Ryder Cup, and then the Masters. I think I've got that right in terms of chronology, because they do sit above the men's professional game as the very cutting edge of the sport. And so who better than to be joined by someone who has taken part in all of those events, English golfer Paul Casey, who has been one of the most successful English golfers over the past 25 years. He's got forearms like Popeye, well, he used to anyway, and he was a prodigious amateur and found himself at Arizona State University in the late 90s and turned pro in 2000. Paul has appeared in 5 Ryder Cups, I think won 15 European or DP World, as they call themselves now, European Tour titles, 3 times on the PGA Tour, and won tournaments all over the world. And I first really came across him when he took £1 million off HSBC at the then World Match Play, which in those days was the sort of the most vulgar first prize in the game of golf. And then he followed that up with back-to-back wins in Abu Dhabi. I think only the deferred prosecution agreement was more expensive for HSBC for a while than Paul Casey. He then cracked on with his career and was very much omnipresent. And I spent a lot of time with Paul at events in China and in Abu Dhabi and around the world. And in July 2022, he joined LIV Golf and is a member of the infamous Crushers team, who I think recorded their last win in Hong Kong a couple of weeks ago. He is an old mate. He really is an old mate. He taught me a lot about how the game of golf works when I was working for HSBC, and I'm really chuffed to have him on the show.
Giles, thank you very much, mate. You've taught me a lot about playing piano late at night.
Well, yeah, I know. It was boring, wasn't it? You know, hotels around the world, not much to do, certainly in Shanghai. Get the piano out and have a sing-song with players and caddies. What could possibly go wrong? I seem to remember once dressing up as Darth Vader, which came as a surprise to many people, including the chairman of the bank at the time, but there we go.
We've done so much together that Justin Rose affectionately used to call me HSPC.
Very good. I didn't know Paul listening.
Giles, please tell me that when you dressed up as Darth Vader, Luke Donald was in the bar so you could tell him you weren't his father. Please, please tell me. Please.
Opportunity wasted. Oh, God, if only. Well, Paul,
that's very good, Ryan.
That's very good. Paul, welcome to the show. I think this could be a very long show. We have got so much to discuss, but just give us a bit of insight. How is life on the new tour? What's going on in the world of your world of LIV and traveling around the world and plying your trade as a professional golfer?
Well, my life is actually it's actually pretty good right now. I mean, as you said, I've played professional golf since turning pro in 2000. I've won, I think I on count on 5 different tours around the world, multiple continents. And I made the move to LIV in 2022. And I've never publicly spoken about why I made the move, and I probably won't give you much more info right here. But one of the, to divulge a little bit, I guess, one of the main reasons was I was very much burnt out. And it's interesting listening to you guys. It's all about the fan, and I believe that in sport. That's why sport exists. But I had treated golf very much as a profession for a long, long time. And I just got to a point of burnout. And with COVID and everything else, and sitting on the PACs and the committees and all the European tours, DP World Tours and PGA Tour, suffering injuries, and basically being fairly unhappy with the state of game of golf, I went for something new, plain and simple, for my own sake, for my family's sake. And that was a long answer to a short question, but I'm actually pretty damn happy playing on LIV right now, I must admit. The state of golf is a whole nother thing, and I have my views on that, which I'm sure you guys will ask me about. But I'm a happy man.
And in terms of the sort of ebb and flow of in the old days, so as a European Tour and PGA Tour golfer, you might play something like, I don't know, 24, 25 times a year. You'd be jetting off from one place to the other. The schedule more geared around something of a season, but very often where sponsors wanted to play, whether it be in the Middle East or in the Far East or whatever. With LIV, what are the commitments there? Is it more sensible for the pro golfer?
Yeah, I mean, I'll dive back into, I guess, my life before a little bit more. I mean, I was playing north of 25. I was playing nearer 30 events a year because being a dual member of DP World and PGA Tour, and you get to that number by having to sort of play your minimums. But also throwing in things like the Olympic Games, throwing in Ryder Cups, you're not actually, not that I'm in control of my schedule now by any means, but, you know, you're not necessarily that much in control of your schedule back then. You're committed either way to play certain events, to, you know, chase the points, qualify for that team, tick this box, do this. And it's just go, go, go. And the problem is, you know, it's all year. I think that's the big thing. It goes from January to December. It doesn't really stop. I mean, there were seasons on DP World Tour. I think Robert Carlson was the year champion for all of, you know, a day, basically. He wins sort of that year, and then suddenly the new season kicks off again. So that's what it was like. I mean, I will say this, and I'll throw this into the mix, which is something I've not talked about, but people know it on LIV, and people know it, you know, on DP World and PGA Tour as well. And, you know, my dear caddy, Johnny McLaren, Johnny Longsocks, as he's known affectionately at. And anybody who wonders what that means, you just have to look up a picture of Johnny and you'll see there's this 50-year-old guy wearing his Jordan ones and his big long socks, you know, lolloping around the golf course. And Johnny and I have been best mates and a team for the last 8 years. Well, Johnny had a brain tumor removed last April. And so there's, you know, when you're never quite sure what is going on in people's lives, there's a lot, you know, and that was something that Johnny and I spoke about. And that was another reason why we went to LIV, because we couldn't keep doing what we were doing. I think the breaking point moments was end of the year in 2021, during all the sort of COVID protocols, let's say, testing. We were throwing out apparently false positives, who knows, on our way to a tournament in Japan, where if you turn up in Japan, you were going to get locked in a hotel room for 10 days, pretty small hotel room by all accounts. And we basically, both of us hit a breaking point, and we just said, we can't do this anymore. So, you know, knowing Johnny's health issues at the time and what we were dealing with, yeah, that's a little bit more of an insight into why I'm currently doing what I'm doing.
And do you think that, therefore, I mean, with your other fellow LIV golfers, there will be many similar kind of stories, particularly the older players, the people who've been true servants of the sport. You certainly have been for the European Tour, people like Westy and Ian Poulter. You'd been plying your trade for a long time. Do you think that would be a similar reaction from some of the senior guard, if you don't mind me calling you senior?
I don't mind at all. 46, I don't mind. I'm close to senior than I am junior, mate. No, I don't mind at all. And I think the thing that's people, maybe it hasn't been discussed, or guys like Westy and Poulter and the others and Henrik have been a little bit thrown under the bus, is that they don't care about the tours they played on in the past. That's wrong. They do care, and they still care. We'll probably get onto the subjects of governance because it's the big thing that drives, has driven this current situation we're in. To be honest, it's the thing that's driven the current situation. But these guys do care about the tour. I still deeply care about the DP World Tour. I deeply care about the PGA Tour. I've got many friends, you know, playing, working, involved with that, sponsors, employees. I mean, it really comes down to just, it kind of comes down to one or two people, doesn't it? But the tours as a whole and our love for them, I don't think has really ever faded.
It's so interesting. I've been looking forward to this conversation for a long, long time. And I've sat and thought about this and my feelings towards it, because I hadn't really had a chance to take stock of it all. And it's been really interesting, because when this whole thing all blew up, I was very much the establishment guy, and I'm, you know, this is dreadful, and I can't believe this, and I can't believe those guys are going, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm very much in the traditionalist camp. You know, I'm an old man now, and I'm an establishment guy. You know, I've recognized something that I've loved as a kid growing up, changing, and I hate change. We all hate change. And, you know, I've watched Rory, who became the face of the resistance, if you want. I've watched him, and I've watched his stance evolve over the last year. And I've been just that little bit behind him. You know, I've seen Rory change. I've gone, Rory, what are you doing? I mean, come on, you need to hold the line here. And then I realized a few weeks later, I'm starting to feel the same. And I watched Bay Hill last week, and I'm halfway through watching the Players this week. And I am now in the Rodney King camp. I'm like, why can't we all just get along? You know, why can't we find a way to make this work? Because none of this is going away. And, you know, I spend a lot of time in my day job talking to people or listening to people talk to me about Bitcoin and crypto. And I've always got an answer for that, which is, look, it's just not for me. It doesn't matter. It's just not for me. And carry on. And I hope you enjoy it. But it's just not really something I want to spend my time on. And I've realized that that's kind of how I feel about the Live team event type stuff. I'm not a glitz and showy guy. I like the substance of the tour. I like the history of the tour. But at the end of the day, there are people that love it, the same way there are people that love Bitcoin, and great. I just want to watch, as I've realized, you know, Rory's become more vocal about, and Justin Spieth and a lot of these guys have become more vocal about. I just want to see you and Poults and Westwood and all these guys teeing up every week on great golf courses around the world. And your point about the governance, you know, Roger nailed this on day one, and he's been consistent with it all the way through this process, and that is the leadership here has been awful. And I don't know the ins and outs. It feels to me like Keith Pelly was kind of hamstrung by Jay Monahan, but it feels to me like the leadership from the very top, which is the PGA Tour, let's face it, has been abject. And I don't know why changes haven't been made. I really don't. And I don't know what you can say about that. You've touched on it, and what you can't say about it. I respect either way. But I'd be curious to know your thoughts on the leadership and why we still find ourselves at a place where there doesn't seem to be the ability to come together. Is it just hubris? Is it just pride? What's stopping them figuring out a solution to this? Because there's a solution there. There must be.
Yeah, there is a solution. And I think, look, the guys who made an early move to Live, I think they saw the writing on the wall. The horse had already bolted. You know, this was happening with or without us, to be honest. You know, the players, you know, have taken the flak for this, but I don't want to say too much, but you brought up Roger's name. So Roger, you'll be very happy. I've purchased three copies of your book, by the way. I've given away two, and I've still got the third one.
You can't find anyone to take the third one.
Oh, easy there, Grant. Easy there. So anyway, let me, because if you haven't, if a lot of people who listen to this have read it already, I know. If you haven't, just go and find it and read it, because it's brilliant. Can you just humor me for a second? I just want to read this. I pulled a quote out later in the book. If we talk about, I'll just cut straight to this bit because I like it. Sport, like the old music industry today, is run by a pretty consistent demographic of 50 plus, mainly white males, okay, who have grown up with a clear idea of what their sport should be. They were fans themselves and most actually are decent people. They have had the luck to preside over a rising tide in the value of sports broadcast rights, which has made them and their companies rich and successful. Blossoming media revenues has deceived these people, convincing them that a bull market was actually their own brilliance and has distracted them from the change that was absolutely needed for a new digital world. Today's leaders of sport, with some clear exceptions, are absolutely the last people who have the will or energy to confront the coming storm. Indeed, in many cases, their thinking is unabashedly selfish to hold on until retirement with the status quo. They are nearly there after all. Let me just finish this up, right? There is no incentive, especially financial, for these incumbent leaders in sport to change. Upton Sinclair, the American writer and political activist, worth a second mention in the book, said it best. It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on him not understanding it.
Amen. Amen. And we now know who's going to record the audiobook for Rog.
I know. I like Roger's dulcet tones. Trust me. He's much better to listen to than I am. I've forgotten what your question was, Grant.
Just talking about the leadership.
I 100% agree, though. I mean, look, I miss playing against these guys. You know, and the fans have not been thought of. The fact that Jay Monahan in his press conference the other day mentioned the fan base or fans, you know, dozens and dozens of times, 40-something times, I think somebody counted. You know, it's too late. You know, it's kind of... You know, this should have been thought of before. You know, I said we take the blame for this as players, but I'm not sure the blame rests squarely on our shoulders. You know, for the longest time, we've just trying to be play golf. That's it.
Paul, if you back up and you look, I mean, it's easy to look back as always and be a revisionist. But if you look back on both the conversations that happened between PIF, Saudi with the European Tour, then obviously creating LIV, the huge amounts of money that have gone in to incentivize players to come across, and all of this being played out in a very public in front of the media. Do you think that at some point, and you talk about yourself as a golf fan first, golfer second, and I've always known that about you. You love the game and you love to watch the game and you play it with your mates, play it professionally, but you're a fan of golf, as is Grant. You know, you just love the sport. Do you feel that there is a sense that with all of this, or everything that's happened, that the game of golf has been sold short, i.e. the 80, 90 million golfers around the world who do love to play, who do love to watch, that somehow they have been neglected by both sides, and that the PGA Tour, and you hear about players talking about for the development of the game, which we know is bollocks. It's the development of their own, you know, looking after themselves, which is fine. It's their job. But do you think a big trick was missed, that the game of golf could have been looked after and that investment could have been made at the grassroots level, at the amateur level, at digitising the game better, et cetera, in order to protect the only thing that keeps any sport going, which is the wallet of the fan, not of itself? That is the value.
100% accurate. Yeah, you're correct, Giles. The best thing that ever happened to golf was the pandemic. You know, golf itself is incredibly healthy. You know, we've got, whether it's the traditional format of the game or whether it's, you know, kids playing it in computer games or whether it's Top Golf. You know, I've got two kids. I've got a 10-year-old and a 6-year-old, Generation Alpha. By the way, Fortnite's fantastic, Grant. Okay, Fortnite's wonderful and I like playing computer games. but they consume golf in a very different manner. But they're still golfers. I'm not in charge, but and if I were in charge, we would have a very different product. Oh, I don't like that word, sorry. We'd have a very different tour if I were in charge. But pumping up purses and increasing events and the schedule and everything is not a way to grow the game. You know, I don't even like that phrase, growth of the game. To me, the tour is... Tours are tours. You go play the golf, you go showcase amazing golf around the world. And I'm talking about every single tour out there, of which there's dozens. I think the growth of the game is a byproduct of a wonderful product. Oh, I've said it. God, it's awful. But it's up to the governing bodies and everybody else and the executives and the governance to get together and figure out how to nurture that growth. As a player, no, it's you go and you play and you devote your life to trying to somewhat master this wonderful game, and that's it. And you smile, and sometimes you throw the odd club, and you sign some hats and autographs, and you it tortures you in the process. But I love it. And if people tune into the game because they like the way I play, or the way Bryson plays, or Rory plays, or whoever Tiger plays, that's wonderful. But don't rely on those guys to grow the numbers. I think the numbers are just fine. You know, we're just out there playing the best golf we possibly can.
So Paul, hopefully you can hear me. When you say the product, I think for sport that is one of the big problems for every sport, is to try and work out what in 2024 is the product. And the difficulty is that it's not for one audience. You know, Grant certainly wants a product of golf very different to your Gen Alpha kids. You tempted us by saying, if I was in charge, I would have a different product. You have to tell us a little bit what you think that would be.
I believe in scarcity, and it's something we don't have in golf currently, and we've not had for an awful long time. I mean, this goes back to, look, first of all, I'll say I really like Jay. Jay is a person, and as a husband and as a man, you know, I've got a lot of time for him, and I sit and enjoy having glasses of wine with Jay a lot. But when his compensation is based around, increasing revenues, you know, you can't. I sat on that player advisory council for a long time. We couldn't ever get him to reduce the playing load. We just couldn't, because his bonus depended on it. So why is he going to reduce the playing load when he's going to take a hit? We couldn't change the structure, couldn't change the governance, couldn't just go, look, we'll give you your money, we'll pay you accordingly, but just do what actually the players want, which is less golf. And I think it's what the fans want as well. So look, I'm not going to give away all my IP, but it would be a lot less, a lot less, Roger. Trust me. You know, what's the window? Is it post Super Bowl to beginning of football season? You know, what is it? It's February to September, something like that. That's what I would have. 20 something events, you know, plus the majors. Scarcity.
I think that's the secret in all the sports. And I think that's what the NFL has got so well, this idea of scarcity, you know, and then they keep it going with the combine and the draft. And every other sport just seems to throw more and more product in from competing governing bodies. And it's just a calendar's a mess. Players like yourself are getting burnt out. You admitted that so beautifully at the top of the show. And again, you know, if you mention Upton Sinclair, let's mention Charlie Munger. Show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome. That's the problem. We are incentivizing people to grow the revenue line, not to other KPIs that are more interesting for the future health of the sport.
Which is why I'm interested in, and I don't know a lot with this SSG deal, what's going to happen there. But, I'm not a PE expert, but they're going to be trimming the fat. It will be interesting to see what happens there.
If we go back into chronology, you were a young college pro in Arizona, I think, in 96, 97. You're 46 years old now. We're seeing where golf ends up, and we don't know the end of the story. But you told me something quite interesting, something that happened in 97 that may be one of the most defining moments of where the modern history of professional golf took off, that you happened to be standing right by it. Just share that with me, because I thought when we will look back in 20, 30 years' time of where golf nets out, almost chapter one, or one of the chapter ones, was at this moment, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. So what Giles is alluding to is I started my college golf career in January 1997 at Arizona State University. It's the university where Phil Mickelson was and various other people, Rick Johansson back in the day, and Pat Perez and some other players, great players. And arrival into the desert was different, and I had the opportunity to as part of the golf team, be working for ESPN that week. And we were calling in the order of play. And I ended up with Tiger Woods' group. Tiger Woods and Omar Urusti. And I'll just fast forward to the juicy bit, which was, there I am standing on the 16th tee at TPC Scottsdale. And Tiger Woods has his infamous hole-in-one. With the beer cans and the beer flying everywhere and the absolute cacophony of fandom. Brilliant. I chuckle slightly because, Grant, I respect your traditional takes on it, but like you were like, you know, Phoenix Open is sort of, you know, it's gone a bit too far. It's like this, you know, you're almost alluding to blaming Liv, let's be honest, which is fine.
He does blame Liv.
He does, it's fine.
He does.
remember, Grant, opinions are not facts, okay?
I have a right to a reply.
You do, of course you do. But that was, yeah. It was an amazing moment. So to finish, it was an amazing moment. You know, the Phoenix Open is one of those that truly... it's where I live. I love Arizona. It's my home. And it's an event that truly transcends our sport. I've got a lot of love for the Thunderbirds that run the Phoenix Open. My blame for this year's Phoenix Open does not go on them, by the way, because they do so much for the community. For those people who are Phoenix residents or Arizona residents will know what I'm talking about. It's gotten a little bit out of control for a few years. But again, I don't blame them. You know, that's the tour's responsibility. It falls on their shoulders. But 97 was awesome. And I think that was just an illustration of the trajectory of Tiger's contribution to this great game.
But maybe that's my point, is that was when Tiger Woods, you know, he'd been talked about, much heralded. He'd just turned pro, hole in one, in front of the world's camera. And that kind of changed the face of what golfers were able to earn with his own extraordinary acceleration to now. And I do bring up the World Match Play win 2006, famously because it was the year that I brought Tiger Woods for his one and only appearance, and he got knocked out in the first round.
How much did you pay him, Charles? And how much did he earn per hole?
Well, I think it must go down as the most expensive round or two rounds of golf in history. And I remember having to go in and see the chairman of the bank on the Friday evening to say, why exactly did we spend this money?
That was great ROI, wasn't it? Well done.
Well done, me. My career's never looked so good.
But it goes back to, I know what you're talking about. I think, look, sport is entertainment. It has been since Roman times. But golf has struggled how to, you know, at what level, what type of entertainment are we trying to provide here? And that's the battle. You know, I'm traditionalist and I, it's funny, you invited me on here to talk about the bucket list, talk about two of the greatest events, not just in golf, but in sport, I'm going to talk about the Open Championship and the Masters. They know exactly what they are. And I love that, especially the Masters. The Masters is, you know, is so in control of what it is. I think the rest of golf is just, professional golf, that is, has just lost its way. What is it trying to be?
Let me come in here. My right to reply.
Of course, Grant. Of course, okay.
Haven't had Donald Trump quotes thrown at me. You know, it's so funny, Paul. You mentioned a word earlier on which I had my hands in the air spontaneously, which was scarcity. And... you know, scarcity is so important. I couldn't agree with you more with that. And of course, the opposite of scarcity is abundance. And we've had this period of time where, from that moment where you were on that tee in Arizona and the emergence of Tiger, because it was from there, you know, he won the Masters a couple of months after that. And then we had this trajectory of Tiger just dominating the game. And I'm struck by, when you go back and look at Tiger Woods' career, and you look at particularly 2000, when he played probably the best golf that's ever been played in the history of the game. It was extraordinary to watch him. You know, what he did in that US Open at Pebble Beach is still, to me, the most dominant sporting thing I've ever seen in any sport before. But the whole of his career was built around him, his talent, and the game. It wasn't built around razzmatazz around him. You know, if you actually think back about what Tiger was, he wasn't flashy and splashy in terms of kind of extraneous stuff, fireworks and this. It was his talent. It was always his talent. And this idea of scarcity breeds tradition, and tradition breeds connection to not just the game today, but the history of the game. And that's the thing that I struggle with so much is, I remember last year, or the first year of Livia, last year, there was a live event on against the Canadian Open. And I thought, you know, I'm going to watch some of this live and just see what it's all about. And I understand it's just not for me, but I found myself going, you know what, I want to see whose name goes underneath Jack Nicklaus and Rory and Trevino and Player and on that trophy. And there was a bunch of no names competing for it, people that weren't, you know, household names. And I just wonder how you manage to find a way back. If we're going to connect the game again, we have to connect the fans to the game. And I just wonder how you find a middle ground between making everything about the superfluous stuff around the game, the parties, the concerts, the noise, the fireworks, the music. And the PGA Tour is following Liv down that path. They believe that this is what we need to do. And my view as a true fan of golf, yeah, an old man, but a true fan of golf is, can we find a way to make it about the game and the talent of the players and not sound bites and social medias, which are all style and no substance?
I don't disagree. by the way, I wasn't trying to throw Donald Trump quotes at you.
I've been called way worse than Donald Trump. Don't worry. Mostly by Roger.
Look, this has been happening. The loss of focus on, should we say, tradition and the history of the game has been going on for a few decades now, certainly a couple of decades now. And I'll use just a sort of benign example. For example, instead of the sort of the traditional, the Canadian Opens and the French Opens and these historic, you know, the Australian events, these historic events, which we've grown up with, and you're quite right, looking at the names on the trophies, you know, they've been turned into, or the Western Open or something like that. They're now a title sponsor, you know. We don't know what we're playing for anymore. We're playing for some newfangled sort of trophy with a title sponsor on it, rather than, I said, the Western Open or the French Open, the Italian Open or whatever it is. So that kind of happened. And I think it's not necessary. It's not a great excuse, Grant, that I've got for you here or counter argument, but it was happening. And so as players, we've become, I guess we've lost our, you know, focus on that to a certain degree. Not every event, but a lot have disappeared. And it's been a pretty sad state of affairs, to be honest. You know, I always argued, you know, what was the legacy sitting on the, I like George O'Grady a lot, by the way, as well. He was pretty good CEO when he was running the European Tour. But I raised the question once, you know, look at the Ryder Cup venues, you know, the Belfry, Celtic Manor, Glen Eagles, Paris National, Valderrama, I think, you know, we don't go back to any of them. In fact, one of them's a live site now. Where's the legacy? You know, it's literally come in. What's the bid? How much money? What are you going to do for us? And then you roll into town, play the Ryder Cup, which, by the way, is the most amazing event ever. And then off you go. What's left behind? Carnage.
You know, Paul, on, you just mentioned the Ryder Cup there, and you know, I have now finished the second season of Full Swing, and you know, I thought it was beautiful the way they showed how much the players cared about being chosen by the captains. You famously took yourself out of the running of one Ryder Cup, and you know, I was just reading about it this week, and I think that was very painful for you. You know, that must have been something that, you know, that people listening to this will feel how much you're traditionalist about golf. How do we all now build on what is something that goes beyond Live in the PGA, which is the Ryder Cup, to bring it all back together and start with a connection? Because there is a connection there in the Ryder Cup. The Ryder Cup connects huge. And you know, you're right, these other tournaments aren't, you know, they just aren't. And it's not golf's fault. It's not anybody's fault. It's just the fact that society and its definition of connection has moved the way away from where it was 20 years ago. It's the same in the music industry. It's the same in the entertainment industry, the film industry, and sports the same. And we're just drifting because nobody has got the leadership to say, what are we going to do about it now? How do we take the Ryder Cup as a base and just say, let's put this all behind us and build something for all of us?
You're right. I mean, you got to, you know, we need somebody with balls and vision. What I'm hoping is Guy Kinnings is going to take over from Keith Pelly very shortly. Guy was actually my manager for a long time when I was with IMG. Hopefully, Guy's previous role before the one he's about to embark on was basically, I guess I messed this up, a director of the Ryder Cup. And he knows that event transcends golf. Hopefully that's the one, that's the, I don't know, the olive branch, the one thing that we can use to bring this all back together. Hopefully he's the one. He's got the, I don't know what to tell you, Roger, but it's interesting that that's the one event where nobody gets paid and we never even question about it. We want to get our expenses, trust me. I mean, there's been a couple of guys, you know, the fly in on the jet and we want to get, you know, get the expenses paid for and all the rest of it. But there's never been a question on our team of, you know, what's in it for me? You know, we're there to try and win a Ryder Cup. Are you proud to put the sweater on? We all know that the Ryder Cup in Europe, in a home Ryder Cup, pays for the following 3 years on the DP World Tour. We're fully aware of that. We know the economics. It's quite scary, really. But it's never been a question. So, you know, maybe there's some other events. I mean, we're going to talk about the Open today. Maybe the Open's another one. Would you happily take a claret jug and no prize money? Damn right.
And do you think that there's an irony to all of this, is that what you just said is that the Ryder Cup remains resiliently the non-paid version of the game, and the game's great tradition, its own sense of fair play, honesty, integrity, which is what golf has built itself on and why it attracts so much investment anyway because of the values of the game, those seem to have been lost or got befuddled. There's something ironic, isn't there, that maybe it's going to be the Ryder Cup, the unpaid version of the element of the game that attracts the non-golf fan, I suspect. Maybe the olive branch that brings everybody back together, or perhaps it should be.
I hope so. I mean, Roger's right. I stepped away from the European Tour in 2014, the birth of my little boy Lex, my first kid. And it was, again, too... It's funny, there's a common thread here, too much. I mean, I was struggling with my golf game outside the top, just on the outside the top 50, and resigned my membership back then, and missed out on... I was not eligible for Ryder Cup until 2018, Paris. It was Thomas Bjorn who asked me to rejoin the tour, and... I used my career money list exemption, believe it or not, to rejoin the tour. Burnt that exemption. It's always like the get out of jail free card that you pull out when you're about 50 years old to have another year. rejoined. You know, had some great conversations with Thomas and I missed it. Roger's right. I really missed it. And my golf game was back to where it needed to be. I was up there in the, you know, FedEx Cup and Race of Dubai and all the rest of it. And what a Ryder Cup. I mean, that's the best experience I've ever had on a golf course. The first tee in Paris was something to behold. And watching Alex Noren roll the final putt in on the week, you know, the whole week was extra special. Jon Rahm's win against Tiger. Everybody contributed. Everybody won a point. It's a perfect week.
I just think that, you know, the more I listen to you, and I don't have the answers either, you know, I'm not sure there's many people more than me that have written about this and talked about this in the last 5 years, but I don't have the answers. But I do think that there is something in the idea that the very top levels of certain sports have nothing to do with money or revenues and have nothing to do with more product and more product. And that is what you earn your way into. Those events, which in golf could be five events, could be slightly more, same in tennis, they don't pay the players. The monies are generated just the same because they are the top of the game and in some way are used to find a model that allows the right structure of the different types of golf or premium, middle of the road and pathway to have a living. There's got to be some kind of model at that. And you know, that's... If I was in that role, I would be sitting around with yourself, the Eddie Pepperells, all the thinkers, and I would say, you all love this game. What is it that we need to sacrifice to still be around in 20 years? That's what I would do.
You're right, Roger. You're right. Like, another event that pops up in my mind, I played the Olympics and I finished in the worst possible place you could finish, which is actually third, which actually meant we had a, we had a playoff, and then I finished, then I ended up fourth. So it was, but no money. And I felt very humbled that week. Tommy Fleetwood and I were the two that represented Great Britain in Japan. It was the delayed Olympics due to the pandemic. I felt immense pride representing Great Britain. Very humbled as well, because we made a point of staying in the athletes' village that week. We weren't going to, you know, I won't call out the players, but you people know a lot of players stayed in hotels that week. Oh, no, I can't possibly stay in the athletes' village. Bollocks. It's the most amazing place ever. And to be sitting in dining rooms with 1,000 athletes, who are true athletes, by the way, I'm just a golfer, who most of them, you know, need jobs, have no money. And I'm sitting there, you know, a millionaire golfer next to Tommy Fleetwood, another millionaire golfer. And you're like, fuck, like, sort of like almost ashamed slightly, you know? And so it's what, to answer your question a little bit, Roger, what's really, really difficult though, is when a guy running a tour gets paid whatever, 18 or 20 million. And he's just had another $2 million pay rise, by the way, last week or the week before. I mean, that's the problem you're facing. It's really difficult to say, I'll play for a lot less or nothing when the renewal.
But Paul, who's approving that salary? Who approves his salary? You know, no, because I know how it works in football, and it's all a little bit of you scratch my back and I'll scratch yours with the national federations that approve the salary of Infantino, who, by the way, has also had a big increase. But in golf, who is it that's signing off on this guy? Because whether you like him, whether he's a good guy, whether he's done a great job, medium or average or bad, that salary is wrong. It's just wrong and it smells wrong. And as you said, it starts players thinking, well, if he's getting that, why should I be Robin Hood? You know, who's approving that salary?
Great question. I don't have the answer for you. I believe the players have tried to change the structure of what it takes to pass a vote. But I think they're slightly outnumbered, you know, player directors versus the execs. Yeah, I'd have to make some phone calls and figure it out exactly. But it keeps changing. The goalposts keep changing in the favour of those sitting at the top.
Paul, can I ask you, is there any chance, and I don't want you to give away any secrets, you can plead the fifth, but is there any chance that somehow we get a push from the players themselves on both sides, so the LIV players, the tour players, coming together and saying, okay, here's what we want. Here's what we would do. Because it doesn't feel to me like they have a voice. It feels like they answer a lot of questions in press conferences, you know, and it's the same guys every time. You know, Rory's thrown up there and he's now said, right, I'm not doing this anymore. So they need, you know, it seems to be JT or Spieth who are now the spokesperson for the PGA Tour. But is there any chance we might see DJ, Bryson, Rory and JT saying, okay, here's what we want to do. Here's what we, the players, want to do. Because ultimately, they have the power.
I would love to answer that, honestly. I have.
Okay.
The only reason there is compensation involved. How do I put it? And so, guys, this goes back to there's no incentive to do that. I think I'm in a very different position, Grant. You know, I've seen it all. I have enough. Like I love playing the golf. I'm playing with Bryson and these kids, like Wacken Neiman and these guys. I mean, I love doing it. But no, there's no incentive for the others. And you've got to remember, if you look at membership, I mean, it's always been the way. There's an awful lot of guys who are just struggling, you know, guys trying to keep their tour card on various tours, guys who are just not interested in the politics. And then you get the guys at the top who make a difference and can affect change, but they have to be motivated. Currently, there's no motivation to have that change, Grant.
Paul, give us an insight of what it's like to be a professional golfer, but particularly a professional golfer around the, let's call it the three flagship events, the bucket list events of the sport, of the Open Championship, the Masters, and the Ryder Cup. But as a player, and you know, the bit that you probably, as a young boy, as you were learning your trade, went to college, this is what you were hoping that you would get to those lofty heights. Maybe in order, start with the open. Just give our listeners a feeling of the difference and why they matter so much, and what it must feel like to stand on the first tee at, say, St Andrews, or indeed at Ryder Cup, which would be different again, and the Masters. Just share something of that feeling, just as, you know, we're all human beings fundamentally standing there on the shoulders of giants.
Well, you've picked two very different events that we're going to discuss, the Open and the Masters. They're literally a juxtaposition of each other. It's the Open, I mean, it's the OG, isn't it? It's the original. You know, talk about format changes. It was 1860 and it was three rounds of 12 holes, Grant, 36 holes. So see, things can change.
I'm old enough to remember, Paul.
it is the one. I mean, it's the only major, stating the obvious facts, it's the only major outside of America. We know that. It's the only one played on links. But there's this, the tradition, the history. There's a vibe to an Open, you know. It's been, and I mean this as a compliment, it's been so amateur through the years in terms of its way it's been run, and I love that about it. It's got this sort of, how do I put it? It's pure. I was going to say rough, but it's not. It's pure, and so the feeling of standing on a first tee, or more actually, even better than that, is the. We'll come back to the first tee, the 18th fairway. When you come in and you come down those expansive, huge grandstands that line the sides of the fairways, go halfway down the hole with the yellow scoreboards, there's nothing better in golf than the walk up the 18th fairway with a crowd, with a sound that they create, claps and cheers, which is unlike any other golf crowd you get. You know, there's different sounds. Augusta has a sound, and crowds at the Phoenix Open obviously have a sound. But the sound at an Open Championship is unlike any other. It's this knowledgeable, appreciative, warm applause you get. And it's really one of the sweetest feelings in golf. And the first tee, it's funny you mentioned the first tee. Ivor Robson, bless him, rest in peace, one of the greatest human beings ever. And to stand there for 11 hours a day, not taking a wee, it's in itself quite an achievement. But again, it's one of those things, it's the noises and the tastes and the smells and the tactile things. And Ivor's beautiful tone introducing the players on the first tee was something that gave the Open Championship its unique special flavor. Alistair Scott is the new starter now, and I'm not going to compare the two. That's unfair. Alistair is absolutely wonderful and does an absolutely fantastic job to replace Ivor, bless him.
And then let's compare that to, then Augusta. So what does that feel like?
There's two things that pop to mind. Well, there's a lot of things that pop to mind. I'll start with obviously, it's the beauty, isn't it? It's the beauty of the golf course. It's the azaleas, the flowers, the pine trees, the pretty patrons, as we have to call them instead of crowds. The green chairs lining the greens. It's this thing of scarcity, and yet it's got rules, which is an interesting thing. You know, as people know, the golf fan knows, it's the only major championship that is played at a private club. And because of that, Augusta can literally, they've got carte blanche to run that as they see fit. And I've got great respect for Augusta National. I've got great respect for the Masters. I love the tournaments. I always have. It was one of the tournaments I first watched as a kid on TV. Sandy Lyle with his little jig in, make you guys feel old now. What was 88, wasn't it?
88.
The bunker shot.
Yeah, probably the last guy to ever win a major with those little kilties on his shoes. Is that what you called them? Those little flappy
yes,
things?
Yes, yes, yes.
And so watching that, you know, being inspired by all the Europeans, the great Europeans winning the Masters in the 80s and 90s, it was it's the thing when you turn up at the Masters. I know, Grant, you've been there. Giles, you've been there too. Roger, if you haven't, it's a bucket list. You have to do it.
Oh, and yeah.
It's one of the few places on the planet that is probably better than you could expect. It's better than you imagine. When you arrive, everything is perfect. Nothing's out of place. The gift shop is better than any sort of boutique store you'd find in London on Bond Street or something like that. I've heard the media center described as a billionaire's mansion. They're not my words. I don't want to offend anybody at Gusta. And it does have these rules. And one of the rules, there's many rules. There's no running and certain things like this, no cameras and stuff. But one of the rules makes the Masters experience for a player unlike any other golf tournament. And that is the rule of no phones. And in this day and age, the digital age, where, you know, we're consumed by all of us obviously looking at our phones and content, and we've got to capture everything we do and see, that rule of not having a phone on the golf course makes the player, speaking from a player's perspective, it makes you feel like a rock star. And it does, because when you stand on that first tee, you could be the first group or the last group. Everybody is watching you. They're not looking at their bloody phones. They're watching you. And that doesn't happen in any other environment that I play in. And it's absolutely fantastic. I love it.
Paul, let me ask you, because you've won 20 plus tournaments on both tours. You've had an incredible career, and you've had top 10s in all the majors. Did you come third to Danny or fourth to Danny in 2016? So, certainly top five finish. What's it like for a pro golfer who's seen everything in the game, played everywhere, won Ryder Cups, won golf tournaments, to contend in a major, to be in that, to be in with a real chance on Sunday of winning a major? How different is that? Because I'm sure you guys go through the motions of, it's just another tournament, it's just another tournament, I've been here before. What's it really like to be in with, you know, to be a shot or two out of first place in the Masters coming down the back nine on Sunday?
It's a brilliant thing. My first Masters was in 2004, and I ended up in the penultimate group in my first Masters. I played with, I think 2004 was Mickelson and Ernie Els battle down the stretch. And I played with Bernard Langer in that penultimate group. And I think I finished seventh or something like that, which was pretty good for a rookie. Actually, it's bloody good for a rookie. Can I be crude? I mean, basically, you're shitting your pants most of the time. You know, that's the truth when you're that young doing it. It's, you get used to it. I think the interesting thing was my early majors were all during the, and I loved it. And I'm saying this out of love, nothing, no regrets. But during the Tiger era, you didn't necessarily have a lot of chance.
right.
So when the opportunities popped up and you found yourself in those sort of last few groups, I mean, it's unlike anything else. They were just on another, and they still are on another level. And what's interesting about the Masters is that all those times I watched it on TV, seeing Sandy or Nick Faldo or Woozy or Lathabelle and these guys win, you know the shots you're going to have to face coming down the stretch. And that's what makes the Masters so different from the Open. If you told me right now, right, the wind's out the east or something silly like that, and you've got Saturday pin positions at the Masters and it's a little bit wet, I could tell you every single golf shot I need to hit for the day. And if I hit the ball in that position of the green, I'll tell you which way the putt's going to break before I've even got there. And so it's this examination paper that's laid out in front of you. There's no mysteries to it. It's like, this
it's
is what it is.
Paper,
it's a bloody
it's
hard paper.
It's just you. It's a, yeah. Right.
And you can make it more difficult by, you know, hitting poor shots or making bad decisions if you're not careful. It's just flat out difficult. Like, I've not won a major. And I'm not in any currently, so, you know, the chances are slim that maybe that boat has sailed. But it's like, I loved it. I really did. And was it scary? Yeah, I wasn't necessarily a guy who was equipped like, we talked about Tiger, you know, that mental ability to deliver the physical and the right sort of emotional decisions, mental decisions in that pressure was quite astounding. You know, it found most guys out. You know, it's but I wouldn't give it up. I wouldn't trade it. I wouldn't change anything that happened.
Paul, can I ask you one follow-up question on that? Because you've opened a door for me to ask a question that I have wanted to ask someone who's been at the very top of the game for such a long time. And you talked about your early majors were in the Tiger era. And you were at the very top of golf during that time. And I've always wanted to know this question. And I think I know the answer, but I'm not going to... I'm just curious to hear what you say. My contention was, as I watched Tiger in his peak in that, you know, 2000 through 2005 period where he was just unbelievable, you know, won 7 tournaments minimum every year on the tour. It was just crazy what he did. And I had this sense, I was like, imagine being the number two golfer in the world, second best player on the planet, and going to a tournament every week and knowing that if the other guy plays his best, you can't win. Was that the sense? I understand as an athlete, you have to push that down, say, no, I can beat him on any given day. But as a fan, that was my sense. If Tiger plays his best, no one can beat him. Was that what the players 2 through 10 in the world, was that their reality or not?
Yes.
Okay.
what really, I've become bitter recently, because what's really peeing me off right now is Tiger's, like, he's got his physical issues. I mean, it's amazing the guy can still walk, let alone play. What's really pissing me off is all these young guys have no idea how good he was. They look at him withdrawing from Riviera the other day, and it pisses me off, because he was so much better than they realize, you know. And no offense, but you can put John Rahm, JT, Jordan, Scottie Scheffler, all of them together, Dustin, all of them together. You can take the best parts of their game. I still don't think they win. And it was for a lot of reasons that people don't realize. You know, the guy was arguably the best green reader and touch putter I've ever seen. Grant, it was amazing stuff. I mean, I got to 3 in the world behind, you know, Tiger and Phil and then myself. I wouldn't change it. Well, I had front row seats. I played with him multiple times at Augusta and places like that, and I loved it. And I had great respect for him. You know, as a golfer, he was wonderful to play with and against. Bloody tough, but I loved it.
What did he teach you anything? Is there anything that, if you, of all the times that you played with him and you were, you know, on the tour, is there anything that he gave you, anything that you would have taken in your career and realized that came from Tiger?
It just needed to be better. or born in a different era. You're trying so hard just to take care of yourself, to be honest, half the time, you know, and do your best, that it was difficult to learn, to be honest, at times.
Paul, as you proved at Wentworth in 2006, match play was a format that suited your game. Tell us just a little bit about what it, for a golfer, which is very much an individual sport, obviously, and yes, you play Walker Cup and stuff, and you learn team golf at an early age, but you mentioned 2018 Ryder Cup, amazing scenes in France, but as a professional, by then you'd been pro for 18 years or something. How nerve-wracking is it to stand on that first tee at a Ryder Cup when you're with your peers, you're representing your continent? What does that feel like? Because I've been lucky enough to go to a few Ryder Cups and be the grinning idiot in the stand supporting Europe, and it is as nerve-wracking as any football or rugby match. But you've got to hit a tee shot straight. What does that feel like?
Straight. Nobody can hit it straight, Gila. You know that. You've got to put shape on it, mate. What is it like?
You're playing a different game, Giles.
That's clearly where you're going.
Right? You're playing a different game. Yeah.
You're... To Giles, straight is straight into the rough.
Exactly. What is it like? It's. I love it. I love the big stage, the Ryder Cups, the pressure. It's why you practice. What is it like? It's a lot of things. You know, your heart's racing, the palms are sweaty, but you're in there this is why you've prepared. This is why you stood on a putting green as a little kid going, replicating this putt to win the Open Championship. I remember it was Nicky Price who won at Turnberry. And I didn't watch it because I was on the putting green trying to do what Nicky Price was doing. And then I watched the replay later. That's so to be in that position, you're already prepared for it. You know, it's excitement more than anything. You know, the Ryder Cup, in fairness, is the only place I've worried about making contact with a golf ball. You know, you sit there, the first tee shot's awful. Once you get going and you're in a match, it's fine. It's different. It's very, very different. But Oakland Hills was my first Ryder Cup in 2004, and it was a very scary proposition at the time. But I've got much better in it, and I relish the moments, whether it's an Open Championship or a Masters or a Ryder Cup. I just want to be there. You know, which goes back to Roger's question earlier. You know, did I miss it? Yeah, I missed it.
You know, giving credit to the people that have put together the series Full Swing, which I certainly enjoyed the last three or four episodes, this one. And on this Ryder Cup thing here, you know, I thought they did it so well that the Americans have got a little chance that they can call it back on the last day, and it's coming down the straight, and Ricky Fowler, who I love, you know, drops it in the water. You know, what is he thinking at that point? You know, before he does it and then when it goes in, what is he thinking? Because he knows what that means. That's game over. How does he come back from that? Just amazing for a civilian like us to have you tell us what that's like is golden, Paul. What that's like.
What's that like? I mean, it's there's so much that I've always struggled with the, you know, guys just basically choke, quit. It's not necessarily the case. Sometimes there's a bad lie. Sometimes it's, indecision, picking the wrong shot. I mean, I don't know what happened with Ricky's shot there. You know, yes, I know the result, but you don't really know what happened. What was he thinking? He certainly wasn't thinking that was going to happen. And Ricky is one of the most lovely guys out there. He's so genuine and sweet. I actually believe even when he saw where the shot was going to end up, I'm not sure he even swore to himself. He's so lovely. but he has the mental ability to just roll with it. Ricky's attitude is very much, it is what it is. You know, he tried, he gave 100%, and it's all you can do. And I respect that.
I heard him say there on video saying, I didn't have it today, as he's putting his head in the towel. And I so felt for him. Because they'd done so well that he'd come back and he'd gone to the coach and got his mojo back, and his head is in the towel. I just didn't have it today.
Sometimes,
and like, I felt for him.
Sometimes that's easier to accept, Roger, than not having it. It's not an excuse, but if you just don't have it, you don't have it. It's better than, you know, with so many variables going on in our sport. It's difficult to, you know, I've got massive respect for these guys. You watch, it's a bit boring really, but you watch like a Max Verstappen and they don't miss their marks, do they? You know, the breaking point, the turning point, the apex, they don't miss, they don't make mistakes. We make mistakes all the time. In fact, our game is just one, it's just, you're just making mistakes around the golf course. Who makes the fewest mistakes? And so if you don't have it, you don't have it. It's almost better than if you do have it and you didn't pull it off. If you have it and you didn't pull it off, you know, but how many times have you got it? You know, how many times did Tiger win with his A game? Almost never. He won with his B game and his C game and his D and his F. So I feel for Ricky, but he shouldn't feel bad. You know, it's he tried. It's all you can do is give 100%.
Paul, on that, can I ask you, it's a fairly rote question, but I'm curious as to the answer. Is what's the shot in your career you'd have again if you had the chance? There must be one that you think, that's the shot I want again.
No, I tend not to. I've got one in my mind. I don't think it would have changed the outcome, though. I pulled the driver into the gorse bush in St Andrews in whatever year that was, when Louis Oosthuizen won the Open Championship and I was in the final group with him. What was that, 2015 or something like that? And I don't think it would have changed the outcome, but... at least I might have had a sniff of a chance. I mean, Louis played absolutely unbelievable golf that day. He missed every bunker and hit every perfect shot. And actually, it might not even be that tee shot. I think actually rewind to the Saturday before, I think I had a birdie chance on 18 from inside of 10 feet and I missed it. So if I'd made birdie there, and then I came out on Sunday and I had a birdie putt on the first hole of inside of 10 feet and I missed that as well. I think if I'd made that putt on Sunday afternoon, evening, Saturday afternoon, evening, that would have been that's one shot.
Yeah, but I mean, such fine margins.
It's amazing I've hit thousands and thousands of shots and I'm pretty good at, maybe not in the moment, people have seen me, my temper on the golf course, but it's... you know, you can't dwell on them. If you go home and you dwell on these things and you think about it, you just internally, you just explode.
Well, and you won the HSBC World Match Play, so you can't say fairer than that. I mean, well, that was a cracking trophy, beautiful looking thing, I think. Paul, we could talk for hours, and we better not. I know you've got that third book of Rogers that you're desperately going to try and hawk around Singapore and try and flog it somewhere.
Leave it in your bedside drawer, like the Bible.
It's like Gideon's Bible.
I don't know if Guy Kinnings is here this week. I could leave it for him, should I?
You could sign it for him as well. Paul, a couple of things. One, on behalf of all of us, thank you so much for joining us. It's just for us to wrap up this series, but particularly to talk about golf, which we've done so much of, to have someone who's been at the vanguard of the sport as long as you have is brilliant. The other thing that we'd like to do, and Roger is far too modest to say, and I hope it will, we can work this out with your schedule, but Roger has put together with his wife the most fantastic event in Lake Como in September, where he asks people that matter to him about the world of sport and where it's going. And I know that he and Grant and I would love you to come along if you can, and maybe do a golf lesson as well, but maybe just come in and share your thoughts with the people who come about where sport in general is going. It's great fun. The food is astonishing, as you'd expect. But if you can come, please do join us.
I appreciate the invitation. I will gladly accept that. I would love to be there. I will share some of the, I'll dig out the IP then.
It's Chatham House rules, so Chatham House. You can see it. Chatham House Chatham rules, House. September 19 and 20.
And you know,
I'll be playing the piano.
You know, I love a lake and a mountain. You saw where I was last week.
Yes,
so
yes.
No, that's so very,
this,
very
this, this is all fine and dandy, but there's only 50. You're not giving in my place, are you, Rog? Because I know I'm pretty expendable in this thing. Let's just talk about this off mic. I just want to make sure the rules here.
No, we're all good. Everybody on this call, including producer James, they're in the Como 50. Absolutely.
Okay, listen, can I ask just one more question before we say goodbye, Paul? Sorry to keep you, but I have to ask you this, because we haven't really, and we should. You're a sportsman who's played at the top of his sport. What's your bucket list event in the world of sport? What's the event that you haven't been to that you would love to?
I've been very, very lucky, Grant, because I've done some of the great events. You know, I've done sort of British Grand Prix and Wimbledon and things like this. My bucket list, you might chuckle off this, is the darts. I want to go Ali Pound.
we know a man who can help you out with that.
And Johnny, my caddy, you know, is a massive darts fan and goes every year. He was there this Christmas. So I've already got a ticket. I mean, if yours is better, I'll happily take it. But it's I'm happy to sit at the back. I don't care. Fancy dress.
Gino.
You know, I'm in.
I think, Paul, I think there's one phone call that needs to be made, and I think you'll find you'll be you're sitting wherever you like. You must come along.
I want to sit right in the middle in the melee. And it just looks fantastic.
It is an astonishing experience. And I think with the plan is, so maybe we can combine this, is that we want to do an Are You Not Entertained from Ali Pally this Christmas. I've spoken to the Hearn family, so maybe we combine all of that and have a bit of a hooly too. What fun. What could go wrong? Nothing.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Wonderful. Paul Casey, thank you so much.
Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Amazing. Enjoy Singapore, Paul.
Will do. Thank you, gents.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Boy, oh boy. How good was that? What a superb guy. It's funny, we've off mic, we were talking about a mutual friend that Paul and I share in the US, and my buddy Joe has always said to me, what a great, great guy Paul is. And Joe's just a lovely guy. He thinks everyone's a lovely guy, but he wasn't even close. What a terrific conversation that was. I loved every minute of that.
Enthralling. You know, normally we're focused on making sure the questions in the right order and, you know, we're chatting, texting between. We missed all of that because I was just listening. And he was prepared to say things in a very authentic way. And listen, you know, when, but after 5 years, you know, when it's a good show, that was one of the very, very, very best, Gilo. Well done.
Well, it's lovely. And I feel that a lot of my my time working at HSBC was when Paul was in the ascendancy. And so I did a lot of work with him. He did a lot of work for the bank, as you'd expect, as well as winning trophies and taking checks from HSBC. And always one of the most interesting guys, very, very honest. And that's what I knew he'd be interesting for our listeners, is that he does not take a backward step and has a real view, even though he's in the middle of it. You know, there's a LIV golfer who's taken LIV money, but he's very honest as to why. And you hear that point of view and it all makes a lot more sense. And yeah, delighted. And I hope he can come to Como because, yeah, I think he'd be a worthy addition.
Amazing, yeah, amazing.
You know, I have to say, it's funny, you know, talking to Paul, it makes you realise that with all this LIV, with all the to and fro between the tour and LIV and the demonisation of the golfers, and I understand where that comes from. You know, I won't say I've softened my stance because I still hate the disarray the game's in. But I don't know why the golfers who've left aren't given a better platform to just talk, right? Because, and yes, in this world today, there'll be plenty of people that listen to this, probably not in our audience because they're very focused on what we do and what we talk about. But in the world out there, there are people that, that will just listen to that and go, yeah, yeah, but you took Saudi money, right? And it's so much more complicated than that. And say, even though I hate what's happened to the game of golf, hate it with a passion, right? And it's something that my opinion of has changed more through the fact that I realized that we're never going back. So why can't we move forward in the best way possible? But the sad thing is, the best way for people to understand and come together is to allow people like Paul a platform to talk, to allow people to listen to someone who's thoughtful, erudite, loves the game, has lived the game at the very top levels. And there isn't enough of that. You know, we end up hearing the Jay Monahans of the world talk. We end up hearing the Rorys of the world answer questions, but not really talk. But you talk to someone like Paul and you get a chance to really listen and it's all there, right? The love of the game, the value of tradition, like all the things that the LIV golfers, the public has decided no longer matters to them. It's just not true. But there's no way, no place, no space for people to talk and people to listen anymore. And it's such a great shame because it is destroying a game that I love deeply. And so does Paul, and I'm sure so does Bryson, and so does Henrik, and so does Poults and Westy and all these guys. You know, it's just such a shame.
Grant, this is an important discussion. So if we've got 5 minutes, let's talk about this because this is really the crux of it, and he did mention this a little bit. If LIV was financed by Sequoia, you know, normal capital, you would not be getting all this criticism of the LIV golfers. It would be much more focused on the why they felt they need to leave. But because it's Saudi, and Jay's smart in this, that was the first card he put on the table. The Saudi cards, shame for the 9/11 families, because he knew if he could get in the mindset of everybody that they had gone for blood money, he would be cut a break. And instead, it's him that's at fault here. It's him. And in this table here, in this group here, it's only me that's been in at the centre of sport in the governing body side. And I left sport after 4 years because I could not stand the governance that I was seeing there, the people that were taking a wage, stealing a wage, not interested, the Cheshire cat smiles in the royal box and all of that. I couldn't stand it. So by reflex, when I see somebody having a go to do something else for whatever reason, the fact it was Saudi that was financing, that was irrelevant to me. It was, finally, hopefully they'll realise that there needs to be a change here. And you know, that's what came out in this episode. You know, the real problem with sport, and that goes to rugby, it goes to what's happening in tennis now with, again, Saudi, is that the current leaders were asleep at the wheel. They didn't have the motivation and the incentives to change. and they've forced their athletes to go somewhere else. It's on them. It's on them. And every time they try and say it's on Saudi, they're trying to deflect. It's on them.
You know, Roger, it's such an interesting point. And I think, you know, all the guys that talk get their little piece of paper with media talking points, right? Before you go in front of the microphone, whichever side you're on gives you your little piece of paper and here, these are our lines, this is what you need to say. And I suspect that if it was Sequoia money, the narrative would have been, you know, private equity, filthy finances, evil investment bank. You know, there's always a narrative as to what the other side is. And I, you know, when I went through this at the beginning, when all this was announced, for me, in all honesty, and I've thought about this a lot over the last couple of years, it wasn't, I understood the attitude towards it being Saudi money. To me, it was always the money. It was always, you're corrupting a game that is about tradition and history, and you're just throwing money at it. So, it, you know, where the money came from, I understood why it was unpalatable to people. I was very much more pragmatic, like you were, about the fact that Saudi Aramco sponsors just about every sport in the world and there's Saudi money everywhere. It wasn't about that. It was about, we are going to take something that has traditionally been all about the trophy and the sporting excellence and winning, and we are going to try and buy it with a whole lot of money. Where the money comes from, I don't really...
I get that, Grant.
I won't care. But I think you're right, Roger. You know, this is the fundamental question. And something Paul said there suggests to me, and maybe this will be forced upon not just Liv and the PGA Tour, but other sports where money has been thrown around, maybe it's going to be forced upon them, hopefully by the players, that we want less. We want scarcity in this. We don't want this to just become...
Wouldn't that be amazing?
It'd be amazing, right? That would be the ultimate perfect outcome for all this, that the money is what finally makes people realize it's not about the money. And stranger things have happened, right? Because that money's going to get more scarce, not more abundant in the world that we're moving into now. And you've talked about this in your book at length. You never know, right? There may be a really good outcome to this. And, you know, Mike Tyson might end the era of celebrity influencers becoming supposed sports stars. And maybe money and the cost of it ends the era of money and we go back to tradition. I live in hope, Roger, and I'm a dreamer, you know that, but that's just me.
J-Lo, what do you think?
Well, I think that the filthy lucre of golf started a long time before Liv. I think there were big, nasty banks who inflated things enormously and changed that. So I think this is the natural next generation was something like Liv. And I think it's interesting, had it been Sequoia, I think there might have been a play which is, yes, but we're going to digitally reinvent the game and it's going to be kind of for the sexy young, and Sequoia would have made it sexy and cool rather than nation state and rather terrifying. My only sort of reflection, having spent a little bit of time in Saudi and listening to people like Danny Townsend and to many others who are plying their trade there in Saudi, is I think Saudi haven't done a great job in perhaps explaining culturally why sport is so important to Saudi Arabia as a country and how it will take itself out from being just becoming much more of a secular state and one where sport is a way to help balance the country out. But that's for another time. I really think that what you've said, Grant, is right, is there is an irony that we all want the same thing, whether you're Paul, Casey, Grant, Williams, me, you, Rog, many of our listeners, is we just want fabulous sport and we want the right amount of sport and we understand what we're playing for, what we're watching for and what the outcome is. And maybe that will be the outcome for golf. And in 5-10 years' time, we're looking back and there will be the Masters, there will be the Open, there will be maybe some sort of live fantastic 6-week team golf format that is really fast moving and attracting the young, and that people who are going to top golf are also connected into both levels. That would be probably success for everybody, and it'll take a little while to iron through. And we've got the privilege of, if you think about the timing of Rog and Grant when you set up this podcast, is that we are kind of the clock set with the change of happening in golf, and I hope that we'll be going for a few years yet, and we can chart the result of where golf got to, which would be a good place, which would be a lovely way to then hang up the microphone and go into obscurity.
Amen. Amen to that. Well, listen, it's time to wrap things up, gents. Our heartfelt thanks to our very special guest, Paul Casey. What a fantastic conversation this has been, Paul. Thank you so much for joining us. Our thanks to you out there for listening. It's always a pleasure bringing you these conversations, and none more so than today, which was just truly a hugely enjoyable time. If you don't follow us on Twitter, that's very easy remedy. What the hell have you been doing? Our thanks also, of course, to our sponsors at Infinity Sports Travel. Without them, we would not be able to bring you these conversations. So thanks very much to Infinity Sports Travel. If you don't follow us on Twitter, that's very easy to remedy. You'll find us at EntertainR. That's the word A-R-E. You'll find me at T-T-M-Y-G-H.
And you'll find me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71.
And myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, until next time.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Jenny.